And it is today's Topical Currents, Tuesday edition. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Bonnie, I guess you're going to rush down and get the playoff tickets for the Heat against the Spurs. Huh?
Yeah, it's just a few minutes till they go on sale,
I guess. You'll be on court, of course, in the expensive seats.
No, I won't.
Well, today we're going to look at nuclear weapons. The Cold War has been over for 20 years, yet nuclear weapons still affect world strategies. This hour we visit with Ward Wilson of the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. He's written the book, Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. Welcome to you, Ward.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Welcome, Ward. So you said you've been working on the ideas for your book for 30 years, which would be while there was still a Cold War going on. Why did it take you so long to write the book?
Well, my friends tease me that it's only 120 pages long, and so that's about 4 pages a year, which means if there's a follow-up book, it won't be for some time. It took a long time because essentially what I was trying to do was to deconstruct the ideas that we use to think about nuclear weapons and try to build a new framework for thinking about them, because I couldn't understand the way that most people talk about nuclear weapons.
And what drew you to the topic so strongly?
I don't know. I do remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was cloudy and overcast and kind of threatening looking in New Jersey that week. And I remember it was the first time my parents had ever experienced them as being truly, truly afraid. So maybe it was a memory of the Cuban Missile Crisis. I don't know.
You say that nuclear weapons are akin to a religion. What do you mean by that?
Well, I do a kind of a pragmatic analysis of nuclear weapons. There tend to be three kinds of people that want to talk about nuclear weapons. There are people who like to be afraid. They go to scary movies and take roller coaster rides. There are people who want to sound like they're important, so they're talking about the most important problem. And then there are people who are kind of interested in the end of all things. And this is not any of that. This is just a pragmatic look at whether they're useful weapons. If they're useful, you keep them. If they're not, then let's rethink. And I think the problem is that there are so few facts about nuclear weapons. They've really only been used once. We have one field test. Imagine having a tool that you'd only used once and you're trying to evaluate whether it works. We used them at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We drew a conclusion from that, and we've pretty much been coasting on that information ever since. So it's not a factually based discussion a lot of the time. A lot of it's belief and emotion.
Well, tell us more about this business that you raise in the book, that the Japanese surrender in 1945 didn't come as a result of nuclear strikes. I mean, what would Harry Truman think about that?
Well, Harry might be secretly relieved, I suppose, because, maybe he would, I don't know, hit me with a piano or something. I don't know. I think that the problem with Hiroshima and Nagasaki, again, is that there's so much emotion attached to it. Americans want to believe that it was all right to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that it was justified. And essentially, that's not the question I'm interested in. I'm interested in whether or not the bombing worked. The morality of it, what Truman knew when he knew it, whether he should have said no, all that stuff doesn't really... I want to look at what the Japanese thought and whether they surrendered because of the shock of the bombing or something. When you look at the facts, when you look at their meeting notes and what they did, it's pretty plain that they surrendered because the Soviet Union declared war on midnight August 8th, midnight between the 8th and the 9th. And that changed the strategic situation. It changed the strategic calculus for them. You could fight one great power, probably maybe get better surrender terms, but you couldn't hold off two great powers attacking from two different directions.
Well, you mentioned that many Japanese cities were completely devastated by conventional warfare, something like 28 or 30 cities there.
Oh, it's the the United States conducted one of the most extensive campaigns of city bombing in the summer of 1945 ever. And part of the reason that the Japanese might not have thought that much about Hiroshima and Nagasaki is because it was buried in the clutter of all this other noise. We destroyed 68 cities in that summer. One of them had more people die, Tokyo, firebombing in March 9th, 10th. Five of them had more square miles destroyed. And 16 of them had a larger percentage of the city destroyed.
You're talking about the Nagasaki and Hiroshima.
You're talking about Tokyo.
The conventional bombings.
The conventional.
There were five conventional bombings that destroyed more than Hiroshima in terms of square miles.
That's what 16. I mean.
Yeah.
Well, why? What would motivate the Japanese and the Americans to perpetuate the myth that they surrendered because of the bombs?
Well, stand in Hirohito's shoes. Now called Emperor Showa, for a moment. And just imagine, you've led your country into a disastrous war. Your cities are a shambles. Your economy's wrecked. Your military's been beaten. Your navy is confined to port because you don't have any fuel. Which would you rather say? We made bad strategic choices. The army and the navy couldn't work together properly on tactical level. We made bad judgments. Or the enemy invented a scientific breakthrough that was akin to a miracle, and that's what beat us. It wasn't really our fault that we lost. They did something that no one could have predicted. So the bomb is the perfect face-saving explanation for losing the war.
And the Americans?
We wanted to win the war. We don't want to say that the Soviet... I mean, during much of the Cold War, who would have stepped forward and said, no, it wasn't the U.S. that won the war in the Pacific, it was the Russians. Because, you know, you don't want to give the communists credit for... But, you know, the fact is the fact. When the morning that the Soviets invaded, Kawabe Toroshiro, the deputy chief of staff of the army, sits in the army meeting and they're talking about what they're going to do, and he says, let's grab the emperor, let's overthrow the government, we'll set up a military dictatorship. And that is a radical step. 3 days earlier, when Hiroshima was bombed, nobody suggested anything radical like that. You compare the two events side by side and you can just see Hiroshima's a problem. It's serious. They know it's serious, but they have a lot of problems that they're dealing with in running this losing war. Soviet invasion, it's a game changer.
You say that everything we think about nuclear weapons is wrong. Explain that.
Well,
it's an absolute, isn't it?
It's a little hyperbole, I'm guessing. Yeah, I originally wanted my publisher to call the book A Few Historically Based Concerns and Doubts About Some of the Things That People Think About Nuclear Weapons, but they thought that was not going to be a good title to sell books.
So sounds a little long.
We ended up with five myths. I just mean that we took that first Hiroshima moment and we decided that nuclear weapons were these huge, looming, awesome, powerful, apocalyptic weapons. And it's been hard for us to zero in and look past all that emotion and see the weapons as they really are. They are really dangerous weapons that create really big explosions that are not particularly useful militarily. They're kind of clumsy. They're more muscle-bound than they are useful. And that is probably why for the last... It shouldn't surprise us that they haven't been used for the last 70 years, because the whole trend is toward precise, intelligent, accurate weapons.
Right.
So, big blundering weapons. So, what I meant by that was that we kind of have this worldview that's out of kilter.
Do you think that most people who are for nuclear weapons see them as a necessary evil, like they have to be here because they keep the world safe?
Oh, I'm sure.
From nuclear...
Yeah. People who want nuclear weapons aren't evil, or, you know, they just see a reality where you've got to have these weapons and you've got to be sure that you keep the United States safe. And I agree with that. I think we want to have our countries be safe.
But you don't think they work as a deterrent?
I think they might work as a deterrent sometimes, but sometimes isn't good enough. If you're going to... Any failure of nuclear deterrence could end up with a catastrophic nuclear war. So for nuclear deterrence, failure is not an option. to use a famous movie phrase.
Right. Where has the deterrence worked, or when?
Well, it's hard to pin down because deterrence operates in the mind of your enemy. And
I was thinking about Berlin in like 1960, 61, when they had that standoff.
And the
wall was built.
Might have had an impact. But I'm not arguing that deterrence never works. I think it works sometimes. The problem is the standard is perfection. And I don't think that – I think there's clear evidence that nuclear deterrence has failed to deter people, particularly in the Cold War, a couple of crises. We can talk about Cuba and some others.
Yeah, we are going to talk about that. We're speaking with Ward Wilson. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute of International Studies. The name of his book is Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. It's Topical Currents. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in a moment.
And it is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. Our topic today is nuclear weapons. We're speaking with Ward Wilson. He's a senior fellow at the British American Security Information Council, and he's based in Washington. Is that correct?
I actually work out of my home in that hotbed of nuclear weapons debate and discussion, Trenton, New Jersey.
Okay.
Oh, all right.
I think I'm the only guy in Trenton who...
If you'd like to join in the conversation, you're certainly welcome. That's 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also email, it's radio@WLRN.org.
Or you can tweet us at Topical Currents. And also, just a note, Ward Wilson will be appearing at Books and Books in Coral Gables tomorrow evening. That's Wednesday, June 5th at 8 p.m. And you might want to go there.
Let's talk about 1962 when... Supposedly, Khrushchev blinked, that the United States also gave concessions, but the fingers were very close to the button.
It was a terrifying time, and I was talking to a very distinguished political science at Harvard one time, and he said, and I was voicing some of these objections, and he said, Ward, the Cuban Missile Crisis proves that deterrence works because the Soviets put missiles in. There was a risk of nuclear war, and they took them out. So what could be more obvious than that? And, of course, I had nothing to say because you only ever think of what you should say until a month later. But then it occurred to me that the real thing is, the question is, what about Kennedy? Kennedy knew that if he blockaded Cuba, that there would be a risk of nuclear war. In fact, I went back and counted in the week of secret negotiations or secret discussions they had about what U.S. policy should be. They mentioned the possibility of nuclear war 60 times. But even so, they decided to go ahead with what turned out to be an aggressive and relatively risky action because we were within a hair's breadth of nuclear war a bunch of times. And one time in particular illustrates the point. There's a U-2 that malfunctioned and strayed 300 miles into the Soviet Union, and they saw it and scrambled MiGs to shoot it down, and we scrambled F-102s to protect it. But because it was the height of the crisis, they had taken all the conventional air-to-air missiles off the F-102s and replaced them with nuclear Falcon missiles. And so if those two sets of fighters had run into each other, there would have been a nuclear explosion over Russia and probably nuclear war. But the reason that they didn't is not because nuclear deterrence works like magic, but because we were lucky.
For those of our listeners who either don't remember or weren't around, what a great tension there was. This is a recording, a television recording of JFK recorded October 22nd, 1963. I can remember him giving this early in the 62, I'm sorry. Yeah, if we could play that.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere. Only last Thursday, as evidence of this rapid offensive buildup was already in my hand, Soviet Foreign Minister Gromyko told me in my office that he was instructed to make it clear once again, as he said his government had already done, that Soviet assistance to Cuba, and I quote, pursued solely the purpose of contributing to the defense capabilities of Cuba, unquote. That, and I quote him, training by Soviet specialists of Cuban nationals in handling defensive armaments was by no means offensive. And that if it were otherwise, Mr. Gromyko went on, the Soviet government would never become involved in rendering such assistance, unquote. That statement also was false. Acting, therefore, in the defense of our own security and of the entire Western Hemisphere, and under the authority entrusted to me by the Constitution, as endorsed by the resolution of the Congress, I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. To halt this offensive buildup, a strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, where they're found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union.
Ward?
It was just an incredible... I was 6 years old, and it was just amazingly frightening time. And we were right to be frightened, because the world came very close to nuclear war. It would have meant, probably, if it had come to blows, even if the United States had gotten in the first strike, still half the population of the United States would have been killed, some 180 million people at that point, and something like, two-thirds of the Soviet population. It was just...
And, of course, with the proximity, Miami and also with Homestead Air Force Base, people were really on alert. Some of the friends I've known who were in this area at the time were talking about everybody was pretty freaked out.
Oh, yes.
And they moved...
Yeah, like Bonnie.
Like me. I lived here at the time.
It was just terrifying. And I think that it's important... I mean, the tendency when you live through something dangerous is to mop your brow and say, phew, we made it, and so we must have been safe the whole time. It wasn't that bad, or I don't know. But people tend to draw the lesson from the Cuban Missile Crisis that, therefore, deterrence must be really, really reliable.
Right.
But, in fact, there are all these things that could have gone wrong. For instance, the Soviets had tactical nuclear missiles in Cuba. We never knew about that. And if we had gone ahead and invaded Cuba, which there were serious discussions about and plans for in the White House, they would have used those tactical nuclear weapons against the naval forces and probably against the Guantanamo base. And that would almost certainly have led to nuclear war.
Of course, coupled with the Bay of Pigs fiasco and the missile crisis, many people think that the animosity from the CIA and the Joint Chiefs of Staff could have contributed to his assassination.
It's always, it's certainly true that there were lots of people who were upset about the Cuban Missile Crisis and particularly the Bay of Pigs.
So we've gone over a couple of the myths, the fact of it didn't cause the Japanese to surrender, that they don't deter, that they're not a deterrence.
Perfectly. They're not, they deter sometime, okay. But they have to be perfect, and it's clear from not just the Cuban Missile Crisis, but other crises as well, that there sometimes doesn't. Sometimes we are fallible emotional creatures, and we get overwhelmed by rage or desire for conquest or whatever it is, and fear doesn't always restrain us.
Okay, what about the myth that nuclear weapons are here and we can't undo them? We can't undo the technology.
I love this myth because It's a very powerful argument. You can't put the nuclear genie back in the bottle. It gets its power from the fact that it's absolutely true. You can't disinvent nuclear weapons. It also happens to be entirely irrelevant. No technology is ever disinvented. You don't disinvent old cell phones in order to have new cell phones. Technology goes away one of two ways. Better technology comes along, or people realize it was stupid technology. So,
our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, we're speaking with Ward Wilson,
about nuclear weapons. 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, and email radio at WLRN.org. And also, if you'd like to tweet, that's at Topical Currents. Let's take a call or two. I've got Ray in Miami. Hi there.
Hi. Wonderful show, a topic that is not being dealt with for many, many years. I have an observation that many people agree with, and that the result of Khrushchev not verifying that he took all the missiles out of Cuba during the Kennedy 1962 conflict indicates that a lot of people think that Cuba still has four or five missiles in active condition facing north, and that's a reason why America in 60 years has not been involved in removing Castro and liberating the island into a full democracy. I have heard very involved people in the high military intelligence ranks in the past few years to say that Cuba is a formidable, very powerful military establishment. Of course, that was 10, 15 years ago. But I do feel that the reason why America doesn't get involved in Cuba and it gets involved everywhere else in the world is because no one is certain that these five or six missiles are not in operation. And I'll take your observations off the phone. I'm 70 years of age. I was here during the missile crisis. My family was involved with the CIA, and I know a lot more than a lot of the younger people that just got on this subject a few years ago. Thank you, and I appreciate your thoughts. Bye-bye.
Okay,
thanks for calling.
So I don't know. I've actually never been to Cuba, so I can't say definitively. I would be surprised if there were missiles in Cuba. There are two reasons. One is that in the modern world, it's really hard to hide anything. You may recall that they recently found a bunch of facilities in Iran that are hidden under a mountain. So if you can figure out that people are doing stuff under mountains, you could probably figure out stuff. But I could be wrong. The other thing is that Kennedy pledged that they wouldn't invade Cuba. And that may be why the U.S. has never done anything in Cuba, because they made a promise not to.
What senior officials, U.S. government officials, have questioned the use of nuclear weapons in its arsenal?
Only retired ones.
Which we were talking about earlier. Talk about that.
Well, I gave a talk in Washington, and there were three really trim, athletic-looking, middle-aged people in the audience. They didn't say anything, and then afterwards we went out, we had were talking, and one of them was a B-52 bomber pilot. And one of them was a B-2 bomber pilot, and she was very impressive, and then a bombardier. And I asked the B-2 bomber pilot, you know, well, what do you think about nuclear weapons? And she stood up straight and said, I would be willing to use nuclear weapons. I have no doubts. There's no question that. And then somebody took me aside afterwards and said, you know, you really put people on the spot when you do that, because if you're in the U.S. military and you express the slightest doubt about using nuclear weapons or their efficacy, you lose your job. They take you off nukes right away and maybe, I don't know, boot you out of the service. I don't know exactly what it is. So there have been a bunch of U.S. officials who have retired who've talked about Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, Secretary of State for Ronald Reagan, William Perry, Defense Secretary for Bill Clinton, Sam Nunn, Senator, Democratic Senator from Georgia, and many others, including, for example, General Lee Butler, 4-star Air Force general, who was the last commander of the Strategic Air Command and the first commander of the Unified Strategic Command of all nuclear forces. But serving government officials and serving military tend not to say that, because, you know, they can't do their jobs if they talk that way.
We're speaking with Ward Wilson. He is at the British American Security Information Council. He's a senior fellow there. And he'll be at Books and Books tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, talking about his new book, Five Myths About Nuclear weapons. And we're going to take another break. We'll be right back.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman, 34 minutes past 1 o'clock. We continue with Ward Wilson. We have lines open if you'd like to join in the discussion with a question or a comment. Easy enough. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, you can email quicker, radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org, or also on Twitter, it's @topicalcurrents. Ward Wilson, let's talk about some of the more contemporary threats to nuclear sanity, North Korea, Iran, etc.
Well, I am less concerned about North Korea and Iran than many people. I mean, to begin with, first, anytime a new country gets nuclear weapons, that's bad. Because the more nuclear weapons there are, the greater the chances are that they'll get used in a war or someone will sell one out the back door.
And you think it's a madman behind it.
Right.
The thing is that relatively small arsenals are not – I don't believe that a madman with five bombs could rule the world. This is in part based on the experience of Germany and Japan in World War II. Germany had more cities devastated. I did some research on this, and I think 80% of their cities had some bomb damage or other above, I can't remember the threshold. And the Japanese, of course, had all but 10 of their largest cities bombed and 50% destroyed. And yet they were able to carry on fighting the war for some time. So destroying five cities is a horrifying prospect. But if you're really determined and you think the enemy is Hitler, that doesn't stop you. You take the punishment and win the war.
So it really doesn't deter an aggressive revolutionary adversary, the fact that, say, the U.S. has this tremendous nuclear arsenal. It didn't. The heavy bombing didn't appear to affect the people in Leningrad. I mean, bombing civilian populations.
It doesn't matter
to the
right
despots.
If you're a despot in a bunker, and you've been starving your people for years in order to be able to afford to build these weapons in the first place. The people are not your first concern. You're a despot. So, you know, the way to coerce people who are autocratic is hardly ever to kill civilians. In fact, I did some research. I went back and looked for a war where killing civilians had led someone to surrender. I've never been able to find an instance where a leader said in history, we have to surrender now because too many civilians are dying. If the army is still on its feet and they're still well supplied and they can fight, the war goes on.
And you're saying nothing does it better, the death of civilians, than
nuclear
weapons.
Nuclear weapons are great at killing civilians. And if that won wars, then they would win wars. But I think that it's essentially, you know, that terrible phrase from the 60s, collateral damage. You're killing lots of civilians, but that doesn't get you where you want to be. You want to beat the other guy's army, not destroy his civilians.
Who would you say benefits the most from maintaining what you call these myths about nuclear weapons?
Well, some people say that it aids U.S. foreign policy, that it keeps the structure of the international, you know, NATO and so on, of the world organized.
There's always the big stick aspect of it background.
If you can frighten people, then that gives you additional influence. What I worry about with nuclear weapons is that it will turn out that they're not as effective as we think, that they're not as useful. We'll imagine we're safe because we have this big stick, and then we'll be in a crisis and we'll suddenly find we need other tools to get the job done.
I'd like to talk about disarmament a little bit. I mean, what would that look like if the United States, Russia, France, if the major countries that have nuclear weapons, agreed, let's say, to disarmament? What would you do about countries like North Korea and Iran?
Well, I think you would let China browbeat North Korea, which is essentially what they do already. When North Korea gets really unruly, we ask China, and I think they supply 40% of the electricity to North Korea, and they're their main ally. So And the other thing is that if all the major powers who have nuclear weapons started to talk trash about them and say, well, these aren't really great weapons, we're going to spend our money on something else, then everyone around the world who admires the world leaders says, wow, the world leaders don't think they're that great. It's hard to imagine a world without nuclear weapons, but, and particularly if you think that a dictator with two or three could rule the world. But it's not that simple, you know. First thing that happens when dictators bring out their nuclear weapons is that the United States, Russia, China, France, England start to rebuild their arsenals. So in 6 months, maybe less, you're back to the status quo. And the other thing is, if you're a dictator and you're trying to cheat, you have to worry about the United States, because we've got stealth bombers, we've got drones, we've got all kinds of conventional weaponry that could, if they find out where your nuclear weapons are, they're clearly at risk.
Let's take another call or two. This is Jose in Miami. Hi.
Good afternoon. I was calling up. I'm Jose from Miami, and I was listening, and I was wondering about some of the myths that you're saying that didn't cause it. In the peace, when the Japanese decided to have the meeting to go for peace, they met with the emperor, and then they decided, was that before or after Russia invaded Manchuria?
Oh, Jose, I love when people ask historical questions. Thank you. So the Soviets declare war and invade Manchuria and Sakhalin Island at midnight on the 8th. They have emergency meetings of the Supreme Council and the cabinet all day long on the 9th. They're deadlocked, and late at night and on early into the morning, they have a meeting with the emperor, and he eventually encourages the military to go ahead and allow them to make peace.
All right, and then also a follow-up question for a second, another point. How many ICBMs did Russia have in 62 that could actually hit the U.S. from Russia?
It's another good question. The Soviets had very few, and I can't remember the exact number, but it was between like 8 and 20. It wasn't a lot, but they were quite large. Maybe it was a little more, but they were quite large, and the studies that The U.S. overestimated the number of nuclear missiles that the Russians had, so that they were calculating based on a somewhat larger number than the reality, we now know in retrospect. But they were calculating that even if they got in the first strike on the Soviet forces, that some of the Soviet bombers would get through, some of the Soviet missiles would get through, and it would devastate the United States.
Tell me, Ward Wilson, if you could just give us a thumbnail of the history of the Star Wars business in the Reagan administration.
So Ronald Reagan comes into office, and they give him a briefing about nuclear war, and apparently, we don't know, he was appalled and shocked and said, we've got to do something about these nuclear weapons. And eventually he did. He and Gorbachev chopped the U.S. and Soviet arsenals in half. But Reagan also said, we're smart, we're Americans, we must be able to build some kind of missile technology that can shoot down missiles. But the fact is, it's actually quite a challenging problem. As President Kennedy called it once, it's like trying to hit a bullet with a bullet. And so there's been a lot of work on anti-missile technology, and we've made some progress, but it's still in its infancy. We're still not at anything like realistic success rates.
How much would you say we spend a year on nuclear weapons?
So we don't know, because the U.S. government doesn't aggregate nuclear weapon spending. It's chopped up and put in the Department of Energy and Department of Defense and so on. But they did a study, Stephen Schwartz and Deepti Chubai did a study in 2009. So the most recent data we have is for 2008. And that we spent that year $52.4 billion on nuclear weapons, which is considerably down from the Cold War. We used to spend a lot more, but it's still a lot of school buses and support for healthcare for elderly people and preschool. So it's a lot of money.
What about the jobs and the economic growth that nuclear weapons create?
No question. Nuclear weapons create a lot of jobs in Tennessee, in New Mexico, and other places around the country. But they tend not to be, they tend to be highly paid physicist jobs, expert scientist jobs. And if you really want to get the most bang for your development dollar, you want to create other kinds of jobs for the rest of us. So, you know, it's important to have physicists, and we should think of ways to make sure that they're involved in the process and we don't forget how to make nuclear weapons. But, you know, it's not a real, it's not a great jobs program.
I just wanted to mention, because Richard Ives wanted us to mention this, that Global Zero is, an, or if you can tell us, Ward, about Global Zero.
Global Zero was founded, I can't remember the year, they're one of the first organizations that talked about going to zero. They had a big movie that they got funded, and they've had a remarkable success signing up high-level ministers and officials from around the world, a very impressive list of military men, government officials, to endorse the notion of Global Zero.
So anybody who is interested in that movement, that's where you would go.
You can check the Global Zero website.
Global Zero. We're speaking with Ward Wilson. He's the author of Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. He's a senior fellow at the British American Security Information Council. One more short break, and we'll be right back. And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. We're speaking with Ward Wilson, senior fellow, British American Security Information Council. And his book is entitled Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. Okay, so another myth, that nuclear weapons have kept the world safe or kept peace, global security, for the last 65 years.
You know, it's certainly true. There's been no nuclear war for 60 years. Nobody doubts that. The U.S. and Russia haven't fought a war. But the fact is, this is proof by absence, which is a really difficult kind of proof to prove. So it's what I call the virgins in the volcano proof. So the volcano erupts, and everyone is horrified, and the priest says, we have to throw a virgin in. And everyone says, a virgin? No, really? What? And then they do, and then the volcano doesn't erupt for a year. And everyone says, see? It worked. So they throw another virgin in, and they keep throwing virgins into the volcano until the next time the mountain explodes. The fact that nothing bad has happened, I could have said last year that the fact that there had never been a storm that caused flooding in New York, New Jersey, and huge damage and destruction all up and down the coastline proved that such a hurricane was not possible, because there had never been one for 200 years. But that didn't mean that Sandy couldn't happen. The fact that there's been no disastrous nuclear war doesn't mean that we're safe from it.
Right.
And we'll take another call or two. This is Panice in Miami. Is that correct?
Correct. That's correct. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I'm a medical student and, you know, a history buff. And, you know, I've always, you know, a huge proponent of trying to the past so we can avoid the future and, you know, avoid mistakes in the future. And you know, I wondered if you could demystify this myth that there was a need to drop the bombs, because conventional estimates at the time state that if we would have invaded Japan, there would have been at least 500,000 lost. So that was why they dropped the bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and I wanted to, you know, get your input on that.
So this is the main debate that people have been talking about for 40 years. They've been talking about, did the bombing, was it necessary? And I apologize, but I don't really like to talk about that, because I'm a pragmatist. I'm focused
sure.
on whether or not the bombs worked. And the assumption, there are two assumptions here. One is that if it was necessary to use the bombs in order to win the war, then that assumes that the bombs worked, and that's what I'm actually questioning. And the other thing is that this debate is really a discussion about whether or not the United States was good or bad. Was it necessary? Did we do a bad thing? And I'm interested in whether or not a pragmatic question, not a moral one. Did the weapons work? You know, that's what I want to know.
People were tired of the war and the deaths.
Sure.
But, so there's a lot of interesting discussion about what Truman knew and how it worked out and whether or not it was, whether they would have surrendered. I frankly think that the Japanese were pretty far from surrendering until the Soviets invaded, because for a number of interesting historical reasons that we can discuss if you come to the bookstore tomorrow night.
Sure,
at
sure,
great I length.
I actually know where the bookstore is.
Okay.
And I would definitely be there. I love the content. It's great, you know, that you're always learning something new and always refreshing knowledge and listening in WLRN. So thank you guys for doing such a great job.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Yeah, have a good day.
Bye-bye. Ward, talk about Israel, a small country threatened by neighbors. Don't nuclear weapons act as a defense of last resort? Mayor and Stewart is asking you.
So I think that, you know, the thing about Israel is that if I were Israel, I don't think that nuclear weapons are magic. I don't think that any technology keeps you safe. I think that what keeps you safe is vigilance and creativity and good diplomacy and military strength and all the classical things that countries have done to stay safe. And you, there is no those. There's no magic sword that you can bring out and it will, you know, protect you in all circumstances. What I worry about with Israel is that nuclear weapons are far more devastating for small countries than for big ones. If I were Israel, I would be the leader in trying to get rid of nuclear weapons. 30 nuclear weapons on the United States would be a tremendous devastating blow, but we could recover. 30 nuclear weapons on Israel would be much, much worse because it's so small, it's so compact. So I have an invitation to go to Israel, and I'm looking forward to it. I've always wanted to go. But I'm not sure that they'll embrace my view with both arms.
What kind of reaction have you had to the book?
So within a few days, I got invited to the State Department for an off-the-record briefing. I got invited to the Pentagon, which was a great time. We had a lot of fun. They didn't agree with everything I had to say, but we had a lot of long discussions, and I admire military men. It worked out really well. Been invited to the UN a couple of times. The United Nations set up a special thing in Geneva called the Open-Ended Working Group. It's a new body designed to work on nuclear weapons issues, and they asked me to come to the opening session to kind of set the tone, or at least I assume they wanted me to set a tone. I've been in Costa Rica for the last 10 days where I gave a presentation with the foreign minister sitting at my left, and I've been encouraging them to hold a regional conference on nuclear weapons. So it's been incredibly exciting, and I'm a little overwhelmed, actually.
So what would you like to see as a next step? I mean, what would you like to see happen?
The most important thing is to think about nuclear weapons in a new way. We think of nuclear weapons as apocalyptic. We think of them as big and looming over us and all-powerful. What we need to do is to just evaluate them pragmatically. Are they really that useful? Do they really get us what we want? Are they all-powerful, or are they a bull in a china shop that you can't really use them anytime because you're going to break a lot of stuff that you shouldn't break?
Tell us more about the British American Security Information Council. You're a senior fellow there. It's based in London.
It's based in London. It's a remarkable group because they have as a goal working towards a world without nuclear weapons, but they believe very strongly in engaging with and interacting with people who have very different views. So they love to sit down with people who are strong advocates of nuclear weapons, people around the world. They've done a lot of work in the Middle East and particularly in the UK, where they're pretty seriously thinking about the UK government has got some people who are pretty seriously thinking about getting rid of nuclear weapons.
Besides the Big Four, which nations still have nuclear weapons?
There are 9 countries that have nuclear weapons, and let's see if I can remember them all. If I can't, then don't buy the book. The United States, Russia, China, France, the UK, India, Pakistan, Israel, North Korea. And, you know, what everyone says is that Iran is going to tiptoe up to the line. They've declared that having nuclear weapons is a fatwa. It's not religiously allowed. But what everyone thinks they're now thinks they're going to do is tiptoe up to the line, stand there, say, we're so close, we effectively have nuclear weapons, and then act as if they have a real arsenal without actually.
How about a website where people can learn more about you and the book?
You can go to BASIC's website, which is www.basicint.org. You can go to rethinkingnuclearweapons.org.
And that's the voice of Ward Wilson. He is going to be at Books and Books in Coral Gables tomorrow evening. That's Wednesday at 8 p.m. to discuss his book, Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons. Ward, it's been a pleasure to have you.
It's been so much fun. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Ward. And thanks for joining us this hour. Apologies to those callers we couldn't get to. Topical Currents is produced by Richard Ives, technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Also, check out the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is with Florida Panhandle attorney Barbara Olschner, who ran for Congress in 2010. A lifelong conservative, she was bitterly attacked and trounced by Tea Party candidates. She's written a chronicle, The Republican, Reluctant Republican. To the calendar. On this day, 1940, 73 years ago, 23-year-old Carson McCullers publishes The Heart is a Lonely Hunter to critical acclaim. Its main character was a deaf man in Georgia. And on this day in 1962, 51 years ago, William Faulkner's last novel, The Reavers, is published. It won a Pulitzer Prize in 1963. Of course, Steve McQueen starred in the film adaptation. One more while even we follow Brad and Jen. On this day in 1975, 38 years ago, the birth of model and actress Angelina Jolie in Los Angeles. Daughter of actor John Voight, at age 14, she said she wanted to be a funeral director. Of course, in February, she underwent a preventative double mastectomy due to a genetic propensity for cancer. Theme music created by Michael Levine. We leave with a thought from Carson McCullers, who was dear friends of Truman Capote and Tennessee Williams. Quote, "I have more to say than Hemingway, and God knows I say it better than Faulkner." Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk the Nation from NPR News.